So are the high roads, except in the East, where a toll is still exacted from the traveller for every mile of his journey. Museums, free libraries, free schools, free meals for children, parks and gardens open to all, streets paved and lighted, free to all, water supplied to every house without measure or stint. All such arrangements are founded on the principle, take what you need. The tramways and railways have already introduced monthly and annual season tickets, without limiting the number of journeys taken. And two nations, Hungary and Russia, have introduced on their railways the zone system, which permits the holder to travel 500 or 800 miles for the same price. It is but a short step from that to the uniform charge, such as already prevails in the postal service. In all these innovations, and in a thousand others, the tendency is not to measure the individual consumption. One man wants to travel 800 miles, another 500. These are personal requirements. There is no sufficient reason why one should pay twice as much as the other, because his need is twice as great. Such are the signs which appear even now in our individualist societies. Moreover, there is a tendency, though still a feeble one, to consider the needs of the individual, irrespective of his past or possible services to the community. We are beginning to think of society as a whole, each part of which is so intimately bound up with the others that a service rendered to one is a service rendered to all. When you go to a public library, not indeed the National Library of Paris, but say into the British Museum or the Berlin Library, the librarian does not ask what services you have rendered to society before giving you the book or the 50 books which you require. He even comes to your assistance if you do not know how to manage the catalogue. By means of uniform credentials, and very often a contribution of work is preferred, the scientific society opens its museums, its gardens, its library, its laboratories, and its annual conversations to each of its members, whether he be a Darwin or a simple amateur. At St. Petersburg, if you are elaborating an invention, you go into a special laboratory, where you are given a place, a carpenter's bench, a turning lathe, all the necessary tools and scientific instruments, provided only you know how to use them. And you are allowed to work there as long as you please. They are the tools. Interest others in your idea. Join with fellow workers skilled in various crafts, or work alone if you prefer it. Invent a flying machine, or invent nothing. That is your own affair. You are pursuing an idea. That is enough. In the same way, those who man the lifeboat do not ask credentials from the crew of a sinking ship. They launch their boat, risk their lives in the raging waves, and sometimes perish, all to save men whom they do not even know. And what need to know them? They are human beings, and they need our aid. That is enough. That establishes their right to the rescue. Thus we find a tendency eminently communistic, springing up on all sides, and in various guises in the very heart of theoretically individualist societies. Suppose that one of our great cities, so egotistic in ordinary times, were visited tomorrow by some calamity, a siege for instance. That same selfish city would decide that the first needs to satisfy were those of the children and the aged. Without asking what services they had rendered or were likely to render to society, it would first of all feed them. Then the combatants would be cared for, irrespective of the courage or the intelligence which each had displayed, and thousands of men and women would outvie each other in unselfish devotion to the wounded. This tendency exists and is felt as soon as the most pressing needs of each are satisfied, and in proportion as the productive power of a race increases. It becomes an active force every time a great idea comes to oust the mean preoccupations of everyday life. How can we doubt, then, that when the instruments of production are placed on the service of all, when business is conducted on communist principles, when labor, having recovered its place of honor in society, produces much more than is necessary to all, how can we doubt that this force, (already so powerful, will enlarge its sphere of action till it becomes the ruling principle of social life? Following these indications, and considering further the practical side of expropriation, of which we shall speak in the following chapters, we are convinced that our first obligation, when the revolution shall have broken the power upholding the present system, will be to realize communism without delay. But ours is neither the communism of Fourier and the Phalansterians, nor of the German state socialist. It is anarchist communism, communism without government, the communism of the free. It is the synthesis of the two ideals pursued by humanity throughout the ages, economic and political liberty. Part 2. In taking anarchy for our ideal of political organization, we are only giving expression to another marked tendency of human progress. Whenever European societies have developed up to a certain point, they have shaken off the yoke of authority and substituted a system founded more or less on the principles of individual liberty. And history shows us that these periods of partial or general revolution, when the old governments were overthrown, were also periods of sudden progress both in the economic and the intellectual field. So it was after the enfranchisement of the communes, whose monuments, produced by the free labor of the guilds, have never been surpassed. So it was after the great peasant uprising, which brought about the Reformation and imperiled the papacy. And so it was again with the society, free for a brief space, which was created on the other side of the Atlantic by the malcontents from the old world. And if we observe the present development of civilized nations, we see most unmistakably a movement ever more and more marked tending to limit the sphere of action of the government, and to allow more and more liberty to the individual. This evolution is going on before our eyes, though cumbered by the ruins and rubbish of all institutions and all superstitions. Like all evolutions, it only waits a revolution to overthrow the old obstacles which block the way, that it may find free scope in a regenerated society. After having striven long in vain to solve the insoluble problem, the problem of constructing a government which will constrain the individual to obedience without itself ceasing to be the servant of society, men at last attempt to free themselves from every form of government and to satisfy their need for organization by free contacts between individuals and groups pursuing the same aim. The independence of each small territorial unit becomes a pressing need. Mutual agreement replaces law in order to regulate individual interests in view of a common object, very often disregarding the frontiers of the present state. All that was once looked on as a function of the government is today called in question. Things are arranged more easily and more satisfactorily without the intervention of the state, and in studying the progress made in this direction, we are led to conclude that the tendency of the human race is to reduce government interference to zero. In fact, to abolish the state, the personification of injustice, oppression and monopoly. We can already catch glimpses of a world in which the bonds which bind the individual are no longer laws, but social habits, the result of the need felt by each one of us to seek the support, the cooperation, the sympathy of his neighbors. Assuredly, the idea of a society without a state will give rise to at least as many objections as the political economy of a society without private capital. We have all been brought up from our childhood to regard the state as a sort of providence. All our education, the Roman history we learn at school, the Byzantine code which we studied later under the name of Roman law, and the various sciences taught at the universities accustom us to believe in government and in the virtues of a state providential. To maintain this superstition, all systems of philosophy have been elaborated and taught. All politics are based on this principle, and each politician, whatever his colors, comes forward and says to the people, "Give my party the power. We can and we will free you from the miseries which press so heavily upon you." From the cradle to the grave, all our actions are guided by this principle. Open any book on sociology or jurisprudence, and you will find there the government, its organization, its acts, filling so large a place that we come to believe that there is nothing outside the government and the world of statesmen. The press teaches us the same in every conceivable way. Whole columns are devoted to parliamentary debates and to political intrigues, while the vast everyday life of a nation appears only in the columns given to economic subjects or in the pages devoted to reports of police and law cases. And when you read the newspapers, you hardly think of the incalculable number of beings, all humanity so to say, who grow up and die, who know sorrow, who work and consume, think and create outside the few encumbering personages who have been so magnified that humanity is hidden by their shadows, enlarged by our ignorance. And yet as soon as we pass from printed matter to life itself, as soon as we throw a glance at society, we are struck by the infinite small part played by the government. Balzac already has remarked how millions of peasants spend the whole of their lives without knowing anything about the state, save the heavy taxes they are compelled to pay. Every day, millions of transactions are made without government intervention, and the greatest of them, those of commerce and of the exchange, are carried on in such a way that the government could not be appealed to if one of the contracting parties had the intention of not fulfilling his agreement. Should you speak to a man who understands commerce, he will tell you that the everyday business transacted by merchants would be absolutely impossible were it not based on mutual confidence. The habit of keeping his word, the desire not to lose his credit, amply suffice to maintain this relative honesty. The man who does not feel the slightest remorse when poisoning his customers with noxious drugs, covered with pompous labels, thinks he is in honor bound to keep his engagements. But if this relative morality has developed under present conditions, when enrichment is the only incentive and the only aim, can we doubt its rapid progress when appropriation of the fruits of others' labor will no longer be the basis of society? Another striking fact, which especially characterizes our generation, speaks still more in favor of our ideas. It is the continual extension of the field of enterprise due to private initiative and the prodigious development of free organizations of all kinds. We shall discuss this more at length in the chapter devoted to free agreement. Suffice it to mention that the facts are so numerous and so customary that they are the essence of the second half of the 19th century. Even the political and socialist writers ignore them, always preferring to talk to us about the functions of the government. These organizations, free and infinitely varied, are so natural an outcome of our civilization, they expand so rapidly and federate with so much ease, they are so necessary a result of the continual growth of the needs of civilized men, and lastly, they so advantageously replace governmental interference, that we must recognize in them a factor of growing importance in the life of societies. If they do not yet spread over the whole of the manifestations of life, it is that we find an insurmountable obstacle in the poverty of the worker, in the divisions of present society, in the private appropriation of capital, and in the state. Abolish these obstacles, and you will see them covering the immense field of civilized man's activity. The history of the last 50 years furnishes a living proof that representative government is impotent to discharge all the functions we have sought to assign to it. In days to come, the 19th century will be quoted as having witnessed the failure of parliamentarianism. This impotence is becoming so evident to all, the faults of parliamentarianism and the inherent vices of the representative principle are so self-evident that the few thinkers who have made a critical study of them, G.S. Mill, Leverdays, did but give literary form to the popular dissatisfaction. It is not difficult, indeed, to see the absurdity of naming a few men and saying to them, "Make laws regulating all our spheres of activity, although not one of you knows anything about them." We are beginning to see that government by majorities means abandoning all the affairs of the country to the tide waiters who make up the majorities in the House and in election committees, to those, in a word, who have no opinion of their own. Mankind is seeking and already finding new issues. The International Postal Union, the railway unions, and the loan societies give us examples of solutions based on free agreement in place instead of law. Today, when groups scattered far and wide wish to organize themselves for some object or other, they no longer elect an international parliament of jacks of all trades. They proceed in a different way. Where it is not possible to meet directly or come to an agreement by correspondence, delegates versed in the question at issue are sent, and they are told, and they endeavor to come to an agreement on such or such a question, and then return, not with a law in your pocket, but with a proposition of agreement which we may or may not accept. Such is the method of the great industrial companies, the learned societies, and numerous associations of every description, which already cover Europe and the United States. And such will be the method of a free society. A society founded on serfdom is in keeping with absolute monarchy. A society based on the wage system and the exploitation of the masses by the capitalists finds its political expression in parliamentarianism. But a free society, regaining possession of a common inheritance, must seek in free groups and free federations of groups a new organization in harmony with a new economic phase of history. Every economic phase has a political phase corresponding to it, and it would be impossible to touch private property unless a new mode of political life be found at the same time. Chapter 4. Expropriation. Part 1. It is told of Rothschild that seeing his fortune threatened by the revolution of 1848, he hit upon the following stratagem. "I am quite willing to admit," said he, "that my fortune has been accumulated at the expense of others. But if it were divided tomorrow among the millions of Europe, the share of each would only amount to 4 shillings. Very well then, I undertake to render to each his 4 shillings, if he asks me for it." Having given due publicity to his promise, our millionaire proceeded as usual to stroll quietly through the streets of Frankfurt. 3 or 4 passers-by asked for their 4 shillings, which he disbursed with a sardonic smile. His stratagem succeeded, and the family of the millionaire is still in possession of its wealth. It is in much the same fashion that the shrewd heads among the middle classes reason when they say, "Ah, expropriation, I know what that means. You take all the overcoats and lay them in a heap, and everyone is free to help himself and fight for the best." But such jests are irrelevant as well as flippant. What we want is not a redistribution of overcoats, although it must be said that even in such a case, the shivering folk would see advantage in it. Nor do we want to divide up the wealth of the Rothschilds. What we do want is so to arrange things that every human being born into the world shall be ensured the opportunity in the first instance of learning some useful occupation and of becoming skilled in it, and next, that he shall be free to work at his trade without asking leave of master or owner, and without handing over to landlord or capitalist the lion's share of what he produces. As to the wealth held by the Rothschilds or the Vanderbilts, it will serve us to organize our system of communal production. The day when the laborer may till the ground without paying away half of what he produces, the day when the machines necessary to prepare the soil for a rich harvest are at the free disposal of the cultivators, the day when the worker in the factory produces for the community and not for monopolist, that day will see the workers clothed and fed, and there will be no more Rothschilds or other exploiters. No one will then have to sell his working power for a wage that only represents a fraction of what he produces. So far so good, say our critics, but you will have Rothschilds coming in from the outside. How are you to prevent a person from amassing millions in China and then settling amongst you? How are you going to prevent such a one from surrounding himself with lackeys and wage slaves, from exploiting them and enriching himself at their expense? You cannot bring about a revolution all over the world at the same time. Well then, are you going to establish custom houses on your frontiers to search all who enter your country and confiscate the money they bring with them? Anarchist policemen firing on travelers would be a fine spectacle. But at the root of this argument, there is a great error. Those who propound it have never paused to inquire whence come the fortunes of the rich. A little thought would, however, suffice to show them that these fortunes have their beginnings in the poverty of the poor. When there are no longer any destitute, there will no longer be any rich to exploit them. Let us glance for a moment at the Middle Ages, when great fortunes began to spring up. A feudal baron seizes on a fertile valley, but as long as the fertile valley is empty of folk, our baron is not rich. His land brings him in nothing. He might as well possess a property in the moon. What does our baron do to enrich himself? He looks out for peasants, for poor peasants. If every peasant farmer had a piece of land, free from rent and taxes, if he had in addition the tools and the stock necessary for farm labor, who would plough the lands of the baron? Everyone will look after his own. But there are thousands of destitute persons ruined by wars, or drought, or pestilence. They have neither horse nor plough. (Iron was very costly in the Middle Ages, and a drought horse still more so. All these destitute creatures are trying to better their condition. One day they see on the road, at the confines of our barren state, a notice board indicating by certain signs, adapted to their comprehension, that the laborer who is willing to settle on his estate will receive the tools and materials to build his cottage and sow his fields, and a portion of land rent free for a certain number of years. The number of years is represented by so many crosses on the signboard, and the peasant understands the meaning of these crosses. So the poor wretches come to settle on the baron's land. They make roads, drain the marshes, build villages. In 9 or 10 years, the baron begins to tax them. 5 years later, he increases the rent. Then he doubles it, and the peasants accept these new conditions because he cannot find better ones elsewhere. Little by little, with the aid of laws made by the barons, the poverty of the peasant becomes the source of the landlord's wealth. And it is not only the lord of the manor who preys upon him. A whole host of usurers swoop down upon the villagers, multiplying as the wretchedness of the peasants increases. That is how these things happened in the Middle Ages. And today, is it not still the same thing? If there were free lands which the peasant could cultivate if he pleased, would he pay £50 to some chable of a duke? Chable of a duke is an expression coined by Carlyle. It is a somewhat free rendering of Kropotkin's Monsieur le Vicomte, but I think it expresses his meaning. For condescending to sell him a scrap, would he burden himself with a leech which absorbed a third of the produce? Would he, under the metayer system, consent to give half of his harvest to the landowner? But he has nothing, so he will accept any conditions. If only he can keep body and soul together, while he tills the soil and enriches the landlord. So in the 19th century, just as in the Middle Ages, the poverty of the peasant is a source of wealth to the landed proprietor. Part 2. The landlord owes his riches to the poverty of the peasants, and the wealth of the capitalist comes from the same source. Take the case of a citizen of the middle class, who somehow or other finds himself in possession of £20,000. He could of course spend his money at the rate of £2,000 a year, a mere bagatelle in these days of fantastic senseless luxury. But then he would have nothing left at the end of 10 years. So being a practical person, he prefers to keep his fortune intact, and win for himself a snug little annual income as well. This is very easy in our society, for the good reason that the towns and villages swarm with workers who have not the wherewithal to live for a month, or even a fortnight. So our worthy citizen starts a factory. The banks hasten to lend him another £20,000, especially if he has a reputation for business ability, and with this round sum he can command the labor of 500 hands. If all the men and women in the countryside had their daily bread assured and their daily needs already satisfied, who would work for our capitalists at a wage of half a crown a day, while the commodities one produces in a day sell in the market for a crown or more? Unhappily, we know it all too well, the poor quarters of our towns and the neighboring villages are full of needy wretches whose children clamor for bread. So before the factory is well finished, the workers hasten to offer themselves. Where 100 are required, 300 besiege the doors, and from the time his meal is started, the owner, if he only has average business capacities, will clear £40 a year out of each mill hand he employs. He is thus able to lay by a snug little fortune, and if he chooses a lucrative trade and has business talents, he will soon increase his income by doubling the number of men he exploits. So he becomes a personage of importance. He can afford to give dinners to other personages, the local magnates, the civic, legal and political dignitaries. With his money he can marry money. By and by he may pick and choose places for his children, and later on perhaps get something good from the government, a contract for the army or for the police. His gold breeds gold, till at last a war, or even a rumor of war, or a speculation on the stock exchange, gives him his great opportunity. 9/10 of the great fortunes made in the United States are, as Henry George has shown in his Social Problems, the result of knavery on a large scale, assisted by the state. In Europe, 9/10 of the fortunes made in our monarchies and republics have the same origin. There are not two ways of becoming a millionaire. This is the secret of wealth. Find the starving and destitute, pay them half a crown, and make them produce 5 shillings worth in the day. Amass a fortune by these means, and then increase it by some lucky speculation made with the help of the state. Need we go on to speak of small fortunes attributed by the economists to forethought and frugality, when we know that mere saving in itself brings in nothing, so long as the pence saved are not used to exploit the famishing? Take a shoemaker, for instance. Grant that his work is well paid, that he has plenty of custom, and that by dint of strict frugality he contrives to lay by from 18 pence to 2 shillings a day, perhaps £2 a month. Grant that our shoemaker is never ill, that he does not half starve himself, in spite of his passion for economy, that he does not marry or that he has no children, that he does not die of consumption, suppose anything and everything you please. Well, at the age of 50, he will not have scrapped together £800. And he will not have enough to live on during his old age, when he is past work. Assuredly, this is not how fortunes are made. But suppose our shoemaker, as soon as he has laid by a few pence, thriftily conveys them to the savings bank, and that the savings bank lends them to the capitalist who is just about to employ labor, that is, to exploit the poor. Then our shoemaker takes an apprentice, the child of some poor wretch, who will think himself lucky if in 5 years' time his son has learned the trade and is able to earn his living. Meanwhile, our shoemaker does not lose by him, and if trade is brisk, he soon takes a second and then a third apprentice. By and by, he will take 2 or 3 working men, poor wretches, thankful to receive half a crown a day for work that is worth 5 shillings. And if our shoemaker is in luck, that is to say, if he is keen enough and mean enough, his working men and apprentices will bring him in nearly £1 a day over and above the product of his own toil. He can then enlarge his business. He will gradually become rich and no longer have any need to stint himself in the necessaries of life. He will leave a snug little fortune to his son. That is what people call being economical and having frugal temperate habits. At bottom, it is nothing more nor less than grinding the face of the poor. Commerce seems an exception to this rule. Such a man, we are told, buys tea in China, brings it to France, and realizes a profit of 30% on his original outlay. He has exploited nobody. Nevertheless, the case is quite similar. If our merchant had carried his bills on his back, well and good, In early medieval times, that was exactly how foreign trade was conducted, and so no one reached such giddy heights of fortune as in our days. Very few and very hardly earned were the gold coins which the medieval merchant gained from a long and dangerous voyage. It was less the love of money than the thirst of travel and adventure that inspired his undertakings. Nowadays, the method is simpler. A merchant who has some capital need not stir from his desk to become wealthy. He telegraphs to an agent telling him to buy 100 pounds of tea. He freights a ship, and in a few weeks, in 3 months, if it is a sailing ship, the vessel brings him his cargo. He does not even take the risk of a voyage, for his tea and his vessel are insured, and if he has expended 4,000 pounds, he will receive more than 5,000 or 6,000. That is to say, if he has not attempted to speculate in some novel commodities, in which case he runs a chance of either doubling his fortune or losing it altogether. Now, how could he find men willing to cross the sea, to travel to China and back, to endure hardship and slavish toil, and to risk their lives for a miserable pittance? How could he find dock laborers willing to load and unload his ships for starvation wages? How? Because they are needy and starving. Go to the seaports, visit the cook shops and taverns on the quays, and look at these men who have come to hire themselves, crowding round the dock gates, which they besiege from early dawn, hoping to be allowed to work on the vessels. Look at these sailors, happy to be hired for a long voyage, after weeks and months of waiting. All their lives long, they have gone to the sea in ships, and they will sail in others still, until they have perished in the waves. Enter their homes, look at their wives and children in rags, living one knows not how till the fathers return, and you will have the answer to the question. Multiply examples, choose them where you will, consider the origin of all fortunes, large or small, whether arising out of commerce, finance, manufacturers, or the land. Everywhere you will find that the wealth of the wealthy springs from the poverty of the poor. This is why an anarchist society need not fear the advent of a Rothschild, who would settle in its midst. If every member of the community knows that after a few hours of productive toil, he will have a right to all the pleasures that civilization procures, and to those deeper sources of enjoyment which art and science offer to all who seek them, he will not sell his strength for a starvation wage. No one will volunteer to work for the enrichment of your Rothschild. His golden guineas will be only so many pieces of metal, useful for various purposes, but incapable of breeding more. In answering the above objection, we have at the same time indicated the scope of expropriation. It must apply to everything that enables any man, be he financier, mill owner or landlord, to appropriate the products of others' toil. Our formula is simple and comprehensive. We do not want to rob anyone of his coat, but we wish to give to the workers all those things the lack of which makes them fall an easy prey to the exploiter. And we will do our utmost that none shall lack aught, that not a single man shall be forced to sell the strength of his right arm to obtain a bare subsistence for himself and his babes. This is what we mean when we talk of expropriation. This will be our duty during the revolution, for whose coming we look, not 200 years hence, but soon, very soon. Part 3. The ideas of anarchism in general, and of expropriation in particular, find much more sympathy than we are apt to imagine among men of independent character, and those for whom idleness is not the supreme ideal. Still, our friends often warn us, take care you do not go too far. Humanity cannot be changed in a day, so do not be in too great a hurry with your schemes of expropriation and anarchy, or you will be in danger of achieving no permanent result. Now, what we fear with regard to expropriation is exactly the contrary. We are afraid of not going far enough, of carrying out expropriation on too small a scale to be lasting. We would not have a revolutionary impulse arrested in mid-career to exhaust itself in half measures, which would content no one, and while producing a tremendous confusion in society and stopping its customary activities, would have no vital power, would merely spread general discontent and inevitably prepare the way for the triumph of reaction. There are, in fact, in a modern state, established relations which it is practically impossible to modify if one attacks them only in detail. There are ways within weaves in our economic organization. The machinery is so complex and interdependent that no one part can be modified without disturbing the whole. This becomes clear as soon as an attempt is made to expropriate anything. Let us suppose that in a certain country, a limited form of expropriation is effected. For example, that, as it has been suggested more than once, only the property of the great landlords is socialized, while the factories are left untouched, or that in a certain city, house property is taken over by the commune, but everything else is left to private ownership, or that in some manufacturing center, the factories are communalized, but the land is not interfered with. The same result would follow in each case, a terrible shattering of the industrial system. Without the means of reorganizing it on new lines, industry and finance would be at a deadlock, yet a return to the first principles of justice would not have been achieved, and society would find itself powerless to construct a harmonious whole. If agriculture were freed from great landowners, while industry still remained the bondslave of the capitalist, the merchant and the banker, nothing would be accomplished. The peasant suffers today not only in having to pay rent to the landlord, he is oppressed on all hands by existing conditions. He is exploited by the tradesman, who makes him pay half a crown for a spade which, measured by the labour spent on it, is not worth more than sixpence. He is taxed by the state, which cannot do without its formidable hierarchy of officials, and finds it necessary to maintain an expensive army, because the traders of all nations are perpetually fighting for the markets, and any day a little quarrel arising from the exploitation of some part of Asia or Africa may result in war. Then again the peasant suffers from the depopulation of country places. The young people are attracted to the large manufacturing towns by the bait of high wages paid temporarily by the producers of articles of luxury, or by the attractions of a most tiring life. The artificial protection of industry, the industrial exploitation of foreign countries, the prevalence of stock jobbing, the difficulty of improving the soil and the machinery of production, all these agencies combine nowadays to work against agriculture, which is burdened not only by rent, but by the whole complex of conditions in a society based on exploitation. Thus, even if the expropriation of land were accomplished, and everyone were free to till the soil and cultivate it to the best advantage without paying rent, agriculture, even though it should enjoy, which can by no means be taken for granted, a momentary prosperity, would soon fall back into the slough in which it finds itself today. The whole thing would have to be begun over again, with increased difficulties. The same holds true of industry. Take the converse case. Instead of turning the agricultural laborers into peasant proprietors, make over the factories to those who work in them. Abolish the master manufacturers, but leave the landlord his land, the banker his money, the merchant his exchange. Maintain the swarm of idlers who live on the toil of the workmen, the thousand and one middlemen, the state with its numberless officials, and industry will come to a standstill, finding no purchasers in the mass of peasants who would remain poor, not possessing the raw material and unable to export their produce, partly on account of the stoppage of trade, and still more so because industry is spread all over the world. The manufacturers would feel unable to struggle, and thousands of workers would be thrown upon the streets. These starving crowds would be ready and willing to submit to the first schemer who came to exploit them. They would even consent to return to the old slavery, under promise of guaranteed work. Or finally, suppose you oust the landowners and hand over the mills and factories to the worker, without interfering with a swarm of middlemen who drain the product of our manufacturers and speculate in corn and flour, meat and groceries in our great centers of commerce. Then, as soon as the exchange of produce is slackened, as soon as the great cities are left without bread, while the great manufacturing centers find no buyers for the articles of luxury they produce, the counter-revolution is bound to take place, and it would come trading upon the slain, sweeping the towns and villages with shot and shell, indulging in orgies of proscriptions and deportations, such as was seen in France in 1815, 1848, and 1871. All is interdependent in a civilized country. It is impossible to reform any one thing without altering the whole. Therefore, on the day a nation will strike at private property under any one of its forms, territorial or industrial, it will be obliged to attack them all. The very success of a revolution will impose it. Besides, even if it were desired, it would be impossible to confine the change to a partial expropriation. Once the principle of the divine right of property is shaken, no amount of theorizing will prevent its overthrow. Hereby the slaves of the field, thereby the slaves of the machine. If a great town, Paris for example, were to confine itself to taking possession of the dwelling houses of the factories, it would be forced also to deny the right of the bankers to levy upon the commune a tax amounting to £2,000,000 in the form of interest for former loans. The great city would be obliged to put itself in touch with the rural districts, and its influence would inevitably urge the peasants to free themselves from the landowner. It would be necessary to communalize the railways, that the citizens might get food and work, and lastly to prevent the waste of supplies, and to guard against the trust of the court speculators. like those to whom the Paris Commune of 1793 fell a prey. It would have to place in the hands of the city the work of stocking its warehouses with commodities and apportioning the produce. Some socialists still seek, however, to establish a distinction. Of course, they say, the soil, the mines, the mills and manufacturers must be expropriated. These are the instruments of production, and it is right we should consider them public property. But articles of consumption, food, clothes and dwellings, should remain private property. Popular common sense has got the better of this subtle distinction. We are not savages who can live in the woods without other shelter than the branches. The civilized man needs a roof, a room, a hearth, and a bed. It is true that the bed, the room, and the house is a home of idleness for the non-producer. But for the worker, a room properly heated and lighted is as much an instrument of production as the tool or the machine. It is the place where the nerves and sinews gather strength for the work of the morrow. The rest of the workman is the daily repairing of the machine. The same argument applies even more obviously to food. The so-called economists who make the just mentioned distinction would hardly deny that the coal burnt in a machine is as necessary to production as the raw material itself. How then can food, without which the human machine could do no work, be excluded from the list of things indispensable to the producer? Can this be a relic of religious metaphysics? The rich man's feast is indeed a matter of luxury, but the food of the worker is just as much a part of production as the fuel burnt by the steam engine. The same with clothing. We are not New Guinea savages, and if the dainty gowns of our ladies must rank as objects of luxury, there is nevertheless a certain quantity of linen, cotton and woolen stuff which is a necessity of life to the producer. The shirts and trousers in which he goes to his work, the jacket he slips on after the day's toil is over, are as necessary to him as the hammer to the anvil. Whether we like it or not, this is what the people mean by a revolution. As soon as they have made a clean sweep of the government, they will seek first of all to ensure to themselves decent dwellings and sufficient food and clothes, free of capitalist rent. And the people will be right. The methods of the people will be much more in accordance with science than those of the economists who draw so many distinctions between instruments of production and articles of consumption. The people understand that this is just the point where the revolution ought to begin, and they will lay the foundations of the only economic science worthy the name, a science which might be called the study of the needs of humanity and of the economic means to satisfying them. Chapter 5, Food, Part 1. If the coming revolution is to be a social revolution, it will be distinguished from all former uprisings, not only by its aim, but also by its methods. To attain a new end, new means are required. The three great popular movements, which we have seen in France during the last 100 years, differ from each other in many ways, but they have one common feature. In each case, the people strove to overturn the old regime and spent their heart's blood for the cause. Then, after having borne the brunt of the battle, they sank again into obscurity. A government composed of men more or less honest was formed and undertook to organize a new regime. The Republic in 1793, Labour in 1848, the Free Commune in 1871. Imbued with Jacobin ideas, this government occupied itself first of all with political questions, such as the reorganization of the machinery of government, the purifying of the administration, the separation of church and state, civic liberty and such matters. It is true the workmen's club kept an eye on the members of the new government, and often imposed their ideas on them. But even in these clubs, whether the leaders belonged to the middle or the working classes, it was always middle class ideas which prevailed. They discussed various political questions at great length, but forgot to discuss the question of bread. Great ideas sprang up at such times, ideas that have moved the world. Words were spoken which still stir our hearts at the interval of more than a century, but the people were starving in the slums. From the very commencement of the revolution, industry inevitably came to a stop. The circulation of produce was checked, and capital concealed itself. The master, the employer, had nothing to fear at such times. He fattened on his dividends, if indeed he did not speculate on the wretchedness around. But the wage earner was reduced to live from hand to mouth. Want knocked at the door. Famine was abroad in the land, such famine as had hardly been seen under the old regime. The Girondists are starving us, was the cry in the worksmen quarters in 1793. And thereupon the Girondists were guillotined, and full powers were given to the mountain and to the commune. The commune indeed concerned itself with the question of bread, and made heroic efforts to feed Paris. At Lyon, Fouché and Collot d'Herbois established city granaries, but the sums spent on filling them were woefully insufficient. The town councils made great efforts to procure corn. The bakers who hoarded flour were hanged, and still the people lacked bread. Then they turned on the royalist conspirators and laid the blame at their door. They guillotined a dozen or 15 a day, servants and duchesses alike, especially servants, for the duchesses had gone to Coblenz. But if they had guillotined 100 dukes and viscounts every day, it would have been equally hopeless. The want only grew, for the wage earner cannot live without his wage, and the wage was not forthcoming. What difference could 1,000 corpses more or less make to him? Then the people began to grow weary. So much for your vaunted revolution. You are more wretched than ever before, whispered the reactionary in the ears of the worker. And little by little the rich took courage, emerged from their hiding places, and flaunted their luxury in the face of a starving multitude. They dressed up like scented fops and said to the workers, "Come, enough of this foolery. What have you gained by your revolution?" And sick at heart, his patience at an end, the revolutionary had at last to admit to himself that the cause was lost once more. He retreated into his hovel and awaited the worst. Then reaction proudly asserted itself and accomplished a counter-revolutionary stroke. The revolution dead, nothing remained but to trample its corpse underfoot. The white terror began. Blood flowed like water. The guillotine was never idle. The prisons were crowded, while the pageant of rank and fashion resumed its old course and went on as merrily as before. This picture is typical of all our revolutions. In 1848, the workers of Paris placed 3 months of starvation at the service of the Republic, and then, having reached the limit of their powers, they made in June one last desperate effort, an effort which was drowned in blood. In 1871, the Commune perished for lack of combatants. It had taken measures for the separation of church and state, but it neglected, alas, until too late, to take measures for providing the people with bread. And so it came to pass in Paris that elegants and fine gentlemen could spurn the Confederates and bid them go sell their lives for a miserable pittance, and leave their betters to feast at their ease in fashionable restaurants. At last the Commune saw its mistake and opened communal kitchens, but it was too late. Its days were already numbered, and the troops of Versailles were on the ramparts. Bread, it is bread that the revolution needs. Let others spend their time in issuing pompous proclamations, in decorating themselves lavishly with official gold lace, and in talking about political liberty. Be it ours to see, from the first day of the revolution to the last, in all the provinces fighting for freedom, that there is not a single man who lacks bread, not a single woman compelled to stand with a wearied crowd outside the bakehouse door, that happily a coarse loaf may be thrown to her in charity, not a single child pining for want of food. It has always been the middle class idea to harangue about great principles, great lies rather. The idea of the people will be to provide bread for all, and while middle class citizens and workmen infested with middle class ideas admire their own rhetoric in the talking shops, and practical people are engaged in endless discussions on forms of government, we, the utopian dreamers, we shall have to consider the question of daily bread. We have the temerity to declare that all have a right to bread, that there is bread enough for all, and that with this watchword of bread for all, the revolution will triumph. Part 2. That we are utopians is well known. So utopian are we that we go the length of believing that the revolution can and ought to assure shelter, food and clothes to all, an idea extremely displeasing to middle-class citizens, whatever their particular, for they are quite alive to the fact that it is not easy to keep the upper hand of a people whose hunger is satisfied. All the same, we maintain our contention. Bread must be found for the people of the revolution, and the question of bread must take precedence of all other questions. If it is settled in the interest of the people, the revolution will be on the right road, for in solving the question of bread, we must accept the principle of equality, which will force itself upon us to the exclusion of every other solution. It is certain that the coming revolution, like in that respect to the revolution of 1848, will burst upon us in the middle of a great industrial crisis. Things have been seething for half a century now, and can only go from bad to worse. Everything tends that way. New nations entering the list of international trade and fighting for possession of the world's markets, wars, taxes ever increasing, national debts, the insecurity of the morrow, and huge colonial undertakings in every corner of the globe. There are millions of unemployed workers in Europe at this moment. It will be still worse when revolution has burst upon us and spread like fire laid to a train of gunpowder. The number of the out of works will be doubled as soon as the barricades are erected in Europe and the United States. What is to be done to provide these multitudes with bread? We do not know whether the folk who call themselves practical people have ever asked themselves this question in all its nakedness. But we do know that they wish to maintain the wage system, and we must therefore expect to have national workshops and public works vaunted as a means of giving food to the unemployed. Because national workshops were opened in 1789 and 1793, because the same means were resorted to in 1848, because Napoleon III succeeded in contenting the Parisian proletariat for 18 years by giving them public works, which cost Paris today its debt of £80 million and its municipal tax of £3 or £4 a head, footnote, the municipal debt of Paris amounted in 1942 to 2,266,579,100 francs, and the charges for it were 121,000,000 francs. Close footnote. Because this excellent method of taming the beast was customary in Rome and even in Egypt 4,000 years ago, and lastly because despots, kings and emperors have always employed the ruse of throwing a scrap of food to the people to gain time to snatch up the whip, it is natural that practical men should extol this method of perpetuating the wage system. What need to rack our brains when we have the time-honored method of the pharaohs at our disposal? Yet should the revolution be so misguided as to start on this path, it would be lost. In 1848, when the national workshops were opened on February 27, the unemployed of Paris numbered only 8,000. A fortnight later, they had already increased to 49,000. They would soon have been 100,000, without counting those who crowded in from the provinces. Yet at that time, trade and manufacturers in France employed half as many hands as today, and we know that in time of revolution, exchange and industry suffer most from the general upheaval. We have only to think, indeed, of the number of workmen whose labor depends directly or indirectly upon export trade, or of the number of hands employed in producing luxuries, whose consumers are the middle-class minority. A revolution in Europe means, then, the unavoidable stoppage of at least half the factories and workshops. It means millions of workers and their families thrown on the streets, and our practical men would seek to avert this truly terrible situation by means of national relief works, that is to say, by means of new industries created on the spot to give work to the unemployed. It is evident, as Proudhon had already pointed out more than 50 years ago, that the smallest attack upon property will bring in its train the complete disorganization of a system based upon private enterprise and wage labor. Society itself will be forced to take production in hand, in its entirety, and to reorganize it to meet the needs of the whole people. But this cannot be accomplished in a day, or even in a month. It must take a certain time to reorganize the system of production, and during this time, millions of men will be deprived of the means of subsistence. What then is to be done? There is only one really practical solution of the problem: boldly to face the great task which awaits us, and instead of trying to patch up a situation which we ourselves have made untenable, to proceed to reorganize production on a new basis. Thus, the really practical course of action, in our view, would be that the people should take immediate possession of all the food of the insurgent communes, keeping strict account of it all, that none might be wasted, and that by the aid of these accumulated resources, everyone might be able to tide over the crisis. During that time, an agreement would have to be made with the factory workers, the necessary raw material given them, and the means of subsistence assured to them, while they work to supply the needs of the agricultural population. For we must not forget that while France weaves silks and satins to deck the wives of German financiers, the Empress of Russia, and the Queen of the Sandwich Islands, and while Paris fashions wonderful trinkets and playthings for rich folk all the world over, two-thirds of the French peasantry have not proper lamps to give them light, or the implements necessary for modern agriculture. Lastly, unproductive land, of which there is plenty, would have to be turned to the best advantage. Poor soils and rich soils, which yet under the present system do not yield a quarter, nor a tenth of what they might produce, would be submitted to intensive culture, and tilled with as much care as a market garden or a flower pot. It is impossible to imagine any other practical solution of the problem, and whether we like it or not, sheer force of circumstances will bring it to pass. Part 3. The most prominent characteristic of our present capitalism is the wage system, which in brief amounts to this. A man or a group of men, possessing the necessary capital, starts some industrial enterprise. He undertakes to supply the factory or workshops with raw material, to organize production, to pay the employees a fixed wage, and lastly to pocket the surplus value or profits under pretext of recouping himself for managing the concern, for running the risks it may involve, and for the fluctuations of price in the market value of the wares. To preserve this system, those who now monopolize capital would be ready to make certain concessions, to share, for example, a part of the profits with the workers, or rather to establish a sliding scale, which would oblige them to raise wages when prices were high. In brief, they would consent to certain sacrifices on condition that they were still allowed to direct industry and to take its first fruits. Collectivism, as we know, does not abolish the wage system, though it introduces considerable modifications into the existing order of things. It only substitutes the state, that is to say some form of representative government, national or local, for the individual employer of labor. Under collectivism, it is the representatives of the nation or of the commune and the deputies and officials who are to have the control of industry. It is they who reserve to themselves the right of employing the surplus of production in the interest of all. Moreover, collectivism draws a very subtle but very far-reaching distinction between the work of a laborer and of a man who has learned a craft. Unskilled labor in the eyes of a collectivist is simple labor, while the work of a craftsman, the mechanic, the engineer, the man of science, etc., is what Marx calls complex labor, and is entitled to a higher wage. But laborers and craftsmen, weavers and men of science, are all wage servants of the state, all officials, as was said lately, to gild the pill. Well then, the coming revolution could render no greater service to humanity than by making the wage system, in all its forms, an impossibility, and by rendering communism, which is the negation of wage slavery, the only possible solution. For even admitting that the collectivist modification of the present system is possible, if introduced gradually during a period of prosperity and peace, though for my part I question its practicability even under such conditions, it would become impossible in a period of revolution, when the need of feeding hungry millions would spring up with the first call to arms. A political revolution can be accomplished without shaking the foundations of industry. But a revolution where the people lay hands upon property will inevitably paralyze exchange and production. The millions of public money flowing into the treasury would not suffice for paying wages to the millions of out-of-works. This point cannot be too much insisted upon. The reorganization of industry on a new basis, open bracket, and we shall presently show how tremendous this problem is, close bracket, cannot be accomplished in a few days, nor on the other hand will the people submit to be half-starved for years in order to oblige the furies who uphold the wage system. To tide over the period of stress, they will demand what they have always demanded in such cases: communization of supplies, the giving of rations. It will be in vain to preach patience. The people will be patient no longer, and if food is not forthcoming, they will plunder the bakeries. Then if the people are not strong enough to carry all before them, they will be shut down, to give collectivism a fair field for experiment. To this end, order must be maintained at any price, order, discipline, obedience. And as the capitalists will soon realize that when the people are shut down by those who call themselves revolutionists, the revolution itself will become hateful in the eyes of the masses. They will certainly lend their support to the champions of order, even though they are collectivists. In such a line of conduct, the capitalists will see a means of hereafter crushing the collectivists in their turn. And if order is established in this fashion, the consequences are easy to foresee. Not content with shooting down the marauders, the faction of order will search out the ringleaders of the mob. They will set up again the law courts and reinstate the hangman. The most ardent revolutionists will be sent to the scaffold. It will be 1793 over again. Do not let us forget how reaction triumphed in the last century. First the Hébertists and the madmen were guillotined, those whom Mignet, with the memory of a struggle fresh upon him, still called anarchists. The Dantonists soon followed them. And when the party of Robespierre had guillotined these revolutionaries, they in their turn had to mount the scaffold, whereupon the people, sick of bloodshed, and seeing the revolution lost, threw up the sponge and let the reactionaries do their worst. If order is restored, we say, the social democrats will hang the anarchists, the Fabians will hang the social democrats, and will in their turn be hanged by the reactionaries, and the revolution will come to an end. But everything conforms us in the belief that the energy of the people will carry them far enough, and that when the revolution takes place, the idea of anarchist communism will have gained ground. It is not an artificial idea. The people themselves have breathed it in our ear, and the number of communists is ever increasing, as the impossibility of any other solutions becomes more and more evident. And if the impetus of the people is strong enough, affairs will take a very different turn. Instead of plundering the baker's shops one day and starving the next, the people of the insurgent cities will take possession of the warehouses, the cattle markets, in fact of all the provision stores, and of all the food to be had. The well-intentioned citizens, men and women both, will form themselves into bands of volunteers and address themselves to the task of making a rough general inventory of the contents of each shop and warehouse. If such a revolution breaks out in France, namely in Paris, then in 24 hours the Commune will know what Paris has not found out yet, in spite of its statistical committees, and it what never did find out during the siege of 1871. The quantity of provisions it contains. In 48 hours, millions of copies will be printed over tables giving a sufficiently exact account of the available food, the places where it is stored, and the means of distribution. In every block of houses, in every street, in every town ward, groups of volunteers will have been organized, and these commissariat volunteers will find it easy to work in unison and keep in touch with each other. If only the Jacobin bayonets do not get in the way, if only the self-styled scientific theorists do not thrust themselves into darkened counsel, or rather let them expound their muddle-headed theories as much as they like, provided they have no authority, no power, and that admirable spirit of organization inherent in the people, above all in every social grade of the French nation, but which they have so seldom been allowed to exercise, will initiate, even in so huge a city as Paris, and in the midst of a revolution, an immense guild of free workers, ready to furnish to each and all the necessary food. Give the people a free hand, and in 10 days the food service will be conducted with admirable regularity. Only those who have never seen the people hard at work, only those who have passed their lives buried among the documents, can doubt it. Speak of the organizing genius of the great misunderstood, the people, to those who have seen it in Paris in the days of the barricades, or in London during the great docker strike, when 500,000 of starving folk had to be fed, and they will tell you how superior it is to the official ineptness of bumbledom. And even supposing we had to endure a certain amount of discomfort and confusion for a fortnight or a month, surely that would not matter very much. For the mass of the people, it would still be an improvement on their former condition. And besides, in times of revolution, one can dine contentedly enough on a bit of bread and cheese while eagerly discussing events. In any case, a system which springs up spontaneously under stress of immediate need will be infinitely preferable to anything invented between four walls by hidebound theorists sitting on any number of committees. Part 4. The people of the great towns will be driven by force of circumstances to take possession of all the provisions, beginning with the barest necessaries, and gradually extending communism to other things, in order to satisfy the needs of all the citizens. The sooner it is done, the better. The sooner it is done, the less misery there will be, and the less strife. But upon what basis must society be organized in order that all may have their due share of food produce? This is the question that meets us at the outset. We answer that there are no two ways of it. There is only one way in which communism can be established equitably, only one way which satisfies our instincts of justice and is at the same time practical, namely the system already adopted by the agrarian communes of Europe. Take for example a peasant commune, no matter where, even in France, where the Jacobins have done their best to destroy all communal usage. If the commune possesses woods and copses, then so long as there is plenty of wood for all, everyone can take as much as he wants, without overlet or hindrance than the public opinion of his neighbors. As to the timber trees, which are always scarce, they have to be carefully apportioned. The same with the communal pasture land. While there is enough and to spare, no limit is put to what the cattle of each homestead may consume, nor to the number of beasts grazing upon the pastures. Grazing grounds are not divided, nor is fodder doled out, unless there is scarcity. All the Swiss communes, and scores of thousands in France and Germany, wherever there is communal pasture land, practice this system. And in the countries of Eastern Europe, where there are great forests and no scarcity of land, you will find the peasants felling the trees as they need them, and cultivating as much as of the soil as they require, without any thought of limiting each man's share of timber or of land. But the timber will be allowanced, and the land parcelled out to each household according to its needs, as soon as either becomes scarce, as is already the case in Russia. In a word, the system is this: no stint or limit to what the community possesses in abundance, but equal sharing and dividing of those commodities which are scarce or apt to run short. Of the 350 million who inhabit Europe, 200 million still follow this system of natural communism. It is a fact worth remarking that the same system prevails in the great towns in the distribution of one commodity at least, which is found in abundance, the water supplied to each house. As long as there is no fear of the supply running short, No water company thinks of checking the consumption of water in each house. Take what you please. But during the great droughts, if there is any fear of the supply failing, the water companies know that all they have to do is to make known the fact by means of a short advertisement in the papers, and the citizens will reduce their consumption of water and not let it run to waste. But if water were actually scarce, what would be done? Recourse would be had to a system of rations. Such a measure is so natural, so inherent in common sense, that Paris thrice asked to be put on rations during the two sieges which it underwent in 1871. Is it necessary to go into details? To prepare tables, showing how the distribution of rations may work, to prove that it is just and equitable, infinitely more just and equitable than the